all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am Hunter in Texas, and joining me in the open prison of Australia is Mr. Stuart Balk. Say hello, Stu.
Hello, happy Australia Day.
Australia Day. Yeah. Drink some VB and roll around in your Holden.
No, don't drink VB because I don't drink, but I do use the fragrance cologne VB.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Very, very patriotic.
They've actually got one, yeah.
And joining us in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado, we have Paul Kersey. Say hello, Paul. John Gray, say hello.
Hey, how's it going?
John looks like he's got that.
He's got that roll of quarters shoved down his pants.
It's in the sock.
It's in the sock
ready
down
to,
the
ready pants. To hit some bum jaws.
Yeah.
So we hope you all had a good break, good Christmas season, good New Year. We're back. This is our first episode of 2022. And so we're ready. You guys want to whip out all your junk? Show what you got?
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. Who wants to go first?
I can.
Okay.
Real quick.
All right.
Okay. Haven't got much because over the break, obviously, we've been away for 6 weeks or whatever it is. Now, if you're on the Discord server that we've got, you would have seen us posting our junk in there. So get on the Discord. I've got the link will be in the description below of this on YouTube. And I must give a shout out to Ben over on Discord, who goes by the name of Giant13, for helping me out. Champion, absolute champion. Thanks for your help, mate, for setting up the Discord server and all that. But the stuff I do have that I am going to show here, I've got from Nez, this lot. It is Hill Street Blues Season 1.
Hill Street Blues.
Hill Street Blues Season 2.
Be careful out there.
TV party tonight.
Hill Street Blues Season 3. And Hill Street Blues Season 4. Never owned these. I've seen the show. Obviously, I was a big fan of the show back in the 80s when it was on as a kid. Never even thought to look to see if the series was available on home video. And, Anthony sent me the first 4. There's still 3 more seasons of those left. So hopefully I'll get them soon. And the last one I've got this in yesterday. And classic. Nashville Pussy's High as Hell, second album of theirs.
Still got mine,
too. Yeah, man. Fuck, they're good. And they're coming out here in September, so I'm going. Can't wait.
They're allowing concerts there.
Yes, finally opening up this wretched hellhole.
Oh, good.
And really, I was actually in the city yesterday, last night, working. Holy shit, it was flat out. Obviously, with a public holiday today, so everyone's partying it up. But good. Good to see this life back in the old joint yet.
All right. John, you want to show yours?
Sure. I don't know if you can see this. It's the Phantom Blu-ray.
It was
a Sci-Fi Channel. I think it was a miniseries that got supposed to be a pilot for a TV show that didn't happen, I think. And
man down, quick. Oh, that's awful, that thing is.
Is it pretty bad?
It's so bad.
It's got mixed reviews. I had never seen it. I bought it for like $5 from Hamilton Books, where they blow stuff out that flop. So I figured I'd give it a shot. I've been reading a lot of Phantom strips lately. And so I'm like, okay, let's see how he did in other mediums that I haven't witnessed yet. You know, I like the Billy Zane movie. I like the Serial, our old podcast covering both of those, a lot of listens. I think we're in the thousands on those by now. But this I wanted to check out. If it sucks, it sucks. But hey, I'm only out $5. So get $1 back if I sell it to Second of Charles.
$5 is fine.
Hang on to it because it's not going to last forever. It's one of those ones that didn't sell much. And I do own it as well. And it's not terrible.
Right.
But it's not great. If you can remember, if I can put it sort of side by side of what it's going to resemble. If you remember the RoboCop TV movies of the early 2000s,
Oh, yeah,
there was four of them. The Canadian
Prime
ones.
Directive or something, or Prime.
That's the ones. Yep. It's very similar to that. Bit more slicker looking, but similar to that.
Yeah, because those were cheap as hell. Those were shot on nothing. Canadian dollars.
They were very, very cheap looking things. But it's okay. Don't even think of it being on the same level as the Billy Zane one.
No, I did not expect that at all.
Nah.
So, is that it for you, John?
Yep.
All right. For me, a lot of this is like holiday haul, so this might seem like a lot. But Eureka had a martial arts movie sale that I took advantage of. So I got King Hu's Reigning in the Mountain. Have you seen this one, John?
Haven't seen it yet. I do have that. I also bought stuff from that sale, but I figured it'd be too predictable if I showed it off. So,
well, I haven't seen the later King Hu movies, so I need to fix that.
Yeah, I bought it for the same reason. I've slacked on seeing them, and they came out from like Kino released them and Eureka released them at the same time, and it was just okay. Who's going to have a sale first for me to get them cheap?
I've got Kino's copy of Legend of the Mountain, but I also got on that sale Mr. Vampire, one of the greatest.
That's a great one.
Greatest of all time. I sold great my film. DVD copy today. Okay.
Did you get the Joseph Quo box set? Yeah.
Not yet. I plan to
move on.
It's worth it. It's totally worth it.
I agree.
Now this movie is probably not very good. I haven't seen it yet, but you know me and you know the director and star, Cry Macho, Clint Eastwood.
Oh no.
Yeah.
I thought you were gonna watch that.
Is it
4K?
What?
Is it a 4K?
Yeah, I know.
I saw the black band at the top. I thought, oh.
I got it as a Christmas present, and I got the 4K. Nice. And
Mr. 4K shelf.
Mr. 4K shelf. And here's a deep cut, Diary of a Country Priest, Region 2.
Oh.
Copy, Robert Bresson. Very artsy. Oh.
Get all fancy and French on us, though.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. I'm Mr. French shelf now as well.
It's from following Paul Schrader on Facebook, you know.
Of course. His psychotic ramblings.
Oh, I know.
That will lead to more low-res memes.
You know what, though? Like, you know, Paul Schrader, you know, he goes on these weird kooky rants, but he's also clearly, like, really sexually charged, even in his old age.
That's why he rants.
It's kind of makes, but you kind of go, okay, like, this is why Paul was Paul, you know? You kind of, as opposed to like the more asexual directors of today, you know?
It's the only reason people follow him on Facebook is because he goes on his psychotic rambling. So.
And I was very pleased to use store credit and not have to pay for this one. Shawscope.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Shit. Yeah. Got rid of a lot of, this enabled me to sell quite a few DVDs.
Yeah. Same here. I've got a stack up ready to go to the DVD store.
Including the Phantom.
it might be joining that pile by Thursday.
Come back next week and tell us where the Phantom is, if it's still there or gone.
I'll say it'll be the second of Charles and Aurora. You know,
I want to go get it
next to the movie theater.
So
they gave me $1.50 for it.
So a few vinyl pieces. I couldn't resist this, even though I don't normally get these things.
Ghosts. I saw that on your Discogs. I thought he bought it. Very cool.
The song Hunter's Moon is just so good. I can't not have it, you know.
So what about your junk spoilers are on your Discogs, basically?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This one, Texas Sun by, I always can't really pronounce the name of this band, Kurongbin and Leon Bridges. It's excellent. If you like 60s, 70s R&B.
No.
It's really good.
I'll check it out on Spotify.
John, I think you would dig it. They're putting out a follow-up called Texas Moon.
That's my type of thing. So.
Yeah.
Along with Hunter's Moon and Texas Moon.
Yeah. Texas Sun and Texas Moon. All right.
Oh, speaking of that real quick, the new Ghost album is out mid-March.
I know. They have a new single out.
Bring it on.
Here's one. Y'all are going to roll your eyes. John Carpenter's Ghosts of Mars.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. I actually, yeah, I saw your John Carpenter binge. I was like, yeah, he's gone on a binge.
You're
John
in a Carpenter. Cult, Hunter.
Don't yes. You realize that? I love his little liner notes. He goes, Ice Cube actually got me thinking about a new way to approach scoring Ghosts of Mars, my 14th soundtrack as a composer. He suggests I work with Pro Tools, a computer software for sound design. After hooking up with Bruce Robb, my producer and favorite creative partner, I met Joe Bishara, Pro Tools sound designer, and loyal Dario Argento fanatic. Our collaboration produced the overall sound you hear on these tracks. In essence, the score for Ghosts of Mars is techno-inspired, as well as drenched in heavy metal. In terms of metal, I knew immediately that I needed the services of Anthrax. Scott Ian, Paul Crook. Paul Crook, by the way, Meatloaf guitarist Paul Crook and Meatloaf producer Paul Crook.
Yeah. So was Bruce Kulick.
Yeah, yeah. And Paul Crook. Paul Crook played with him through like the latter albums, like Hang Cool Teddy Bear and Hell in a Handbasket and Bat Out of Hell, or what? Not the Bat Out of Hell, but anyway, you know what I mean. And he was his live guitar player. But Frank Bello and Charlie Benante for the tracks, with additional fury that my synth underscoring sounded. They played the tracks with such fury that my synth underscoring sounded like Muzak. Additionally, Steve Vai, Elliot Easton, Buckethead, Robin Fink, Brad Wilson, Joe Robb, JJ Garcia, Brian James, and Bucket Baker helped me get this thing up on its feet. John, you're going to love this next part. And what did Ice Cube think of my score? I don't really know for certain, but I'm told he thought it sounded like 70s music. Fair enough, but I must thank him for the inspiration.
Ice Cube wanted some anti-Semitic lyrics and some burning down Korean stores.
Man, all of a sudden, John's purchase on the fender doesn't seem so bad compared to that. Yeah.
I know that Hunter will always outdo me, especially in the quantity and the lack of quality.
Yes, and lack of quality. Speaking of Devin Townsend Acoustic Live, and
It was definitely lack of quality.
Last but not least, King's X's Please Come Home, Mr. Bulbous.
Oh my God, Rock Month flashbacks.
First time on vinyl. Yep.
Yeah, really.
So
King's X and Devin Townsend Rock Month.
Yeah.
Can't play that in your car, Hunter.
No. Nope. And that's the idea, is to piss off Eddie Trunk. So.
And indulge in your junk science of vinyl.
Yes. And speaking of junk science and junk and Rock Month.
Yeah.
The film we're doing this week is The Great Rock and Roll Swindle, the Sex Pistols movie directed by Julian Temple, the chronicler of punk, I guess. Yeah, there's Stu with his copy.
Well, English punk, at least.
Yes, like he just did one on the Pogues.
Which I want to see. I don't care for the band, but that Shane McGowan is a train wreck of an individual. So
yeah, the Pogues are a band I'd find their story interesting, but their music gets old after like one song when you listen to them. It's like,
I'd say about half a song.
I get it. Okay.
Yeah, the interview is his dentist, like Shane's dentist.
He doesn't have one. He doesn't have a dentist. So no.
Find this blind guy with like no hands.
So, Stu, you picked this. Why did you pick The Great Rock and Roll Swindle?
Well, it's been one that I personally want us to have done many, many years ago, but other things came about and never eventuated. And while we had the downtime, I watched it over the Christmas period. Went on a bit of a Sex Pistols kick with that. I watched The Filth and the Fury. Suffered through Sid Nancy, which ended up giving to one of my sons because it was just an awful movie.
You're inflicting it on your sons.
Oh, no, I gave it to him. He goes, well, thanks, Dad. And then we'll talk about it earlier today. He goes, it's not that good.
Potato to potato.
yeah, really. And just, I thought, well, get it out of the way. And because you'd said you'd never seen it, right?
No, I'd seen Filth and the Fury, which is also Julian Temple.
Yeah, that's the other side of the coin compared to this. Yeah, that's the rebuttal to this. John, I was pretty sure would have seen it, but I wasn't sure. Yeah, I figured you would have.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I'll make an interesting discussion. See how we go about it.
Yeah. That's all. Well, you know, I had been exposed to this through The Filth and the Fury, because a lot of the footage from it shows up in there.
No, none of the footage in The Filth and Fury is from this.
No. I meant the footage from this is in Filth and the Fury. Like, there's footage of the cartoons and stuff like that.
Oh, the cartoons, yes, but the actual live action footage in that is actually outtake stuff.
I just remembered seeing
it. I get you saying, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I'd always heard about it, but I'd never watched it. And looking at it now, you know, I know a fair bit about the Sex Pistols, but this was a big blind spot because I didn't know anything about them making this film after Johnny Rotten, aka John Lydon, had left the band. You know, this movie came as the band was imploding. And I didn't know about them doing these songs with other singers, getting a train robber to sing on a song. You know, there's a lot of crazy, weird stuff in here, but it's also an excuse for Malcolm McLaren to, you know, parade himself around in front of the camera and make himself the star of the show.
Yeah. And rewrite history, basically.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, he kind of makes it seem like the Sex Pistols were this great sleight of hand, this great con job he pulled on England. And I'm going, you know, it doesn't seem like it adds up. And the big takeaway I had from this movie was that the Sex Pistols, you know, that this whole operation falls apart without John Lydon.
Yeah. Yep.
Because he is the talent in that band. He's the personality. He's everything. And that scene at the beginning where you have the band playing and all these different people singing, I was going,
nah, I love it. I love that song, man. So good. No, I mean, none of the singers save for Edward Tudor Pole, who's the guy who rolls up later as the one of the ushers at the theater singing Who Killed Bambi. The rest of them are shit. The singers are just awful.
Right.
And even Steve Jones, I watched an interview with him, and he goes, none of them were going to make it. He goes, by the time we were doing it, it was all over. It was just contractually we did it. None of them stood a chance.
And even Steve Jones kind of has to carry this movie doing this, like, PI shtick.
Yeah.
I mean, I like Jonesy. I like him a lot, but he can't carry a band. You know, he can't carry he doesn't have the personality. Even Sid Vicious has more personality than him, and even that guy is, you know, just a picture.
Sid Vicious in this film is wasted. He's gone. There's no, Lord knows if he had any memory of making it. Jones himself was on heroin during this film as well, and guys, I just did what they told me to do.
And they joke a lot about his perversions in it, but he's in SA, you know, like now, and he's always talked about, like, being just a fiend for sex, you know, just a sex addict, you know.
Mm.
Yeah.
And there's tons of jokes about it, but I heard him on, like, Dr. Drew talking about it, and he was just like, yeah, man, I just felt, I was completely dead inside, like, you know, felt nothing. But Vicious does have, he has that, the one iconic moment is the My Way thing. You know,
you know, that's what this film is well known for, probably more than anything, is the My Way segment.
Mm-hmm.
Which I mean, it's good, very well created in Sid and Nancy. I'll give them that much.
Yeah.
And as I said, Sid and Nancy, I will not fault Gary Oldman at all or Chloe Webb. Yeah, but you know, Alex Cox is an abomination.
Yeah, and the biggest sin that movie commits, and you can tell that, is the way it rewrites history, is it PCs Sid Vicious. You know, in this movie, we see Sid Vicious wearing Nazi paraphernalia because it's shocking.
Yeah.
Right? In Sid and Nancy, he's wearing commie paraphernalia. Not because it's shocking, but it's because that's the extreme politics that Alex Cox likes.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's totally cowardly to do that.
Yeah, he's a cowardly communist anyway.
Yeah.
Where's the lie?
I mean, the scenes of Sid Vicious walking through Paris with a swastika on. He was actually walking through the Jewish sector of Paris. That's why I filmed it, because I wanted to get a reaction.
There is a lot of, one thing I realized watching this, I never made the connection that the song Belson's Aghast is a Holocaust joke.
Oh yeah.
I never thought about that. And then I saw it in this movie and I went, wait, that's a Holocaust joke. How did I?
Didn't you hear the lyrics to it?
I don't think I've ever listened. I think I've listened Belson to that song
was,
like once.
Belson was aghast. I heard something say, in the open graves where the Jews all lay. So, I mean.
Yeah, I don't think I ever listened to the lyrics. I think it's just one that passed me by. But, yeah. You know, I didn't realize the level of kind of Nazi humor that's in those Sex Pistols.
Dentists search their teeth for gold. Frisk the Jews for banknotes rolled.
Yeah.
What's that line? When they found out what they got, lined them up and shoot the lot. So, yeah, it's pretty full on. It's a full on song.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, because I knew that they would wear like t-shirts with swastikas on them, but I did not realize how much there was until this movie.
Well, that was a song you could, back in like the 80s, you could really only hear it on like those. There would be all these Sex Pistols bootlegs of legally dubious quality that mm-hmm. you'd find in record stores. Because Nevermind the Bollocks wasn't always very easy to find, but strangely, you could find all these other weird bootlegs that would combine demos for like Belson Was a Gas. And,
like Spunk?
Yeah, live tracks, and then there would be like radio ads from America during their ill-fated tour, and clips from Winterland, that sort of stuff. So you'd have to listen to the lyrics. It's all you could really hear. You couldn't hear much music. The recordings were so terrible.
Well, Belson Was a Gas is on the soundtrack to this film. So, I mean, that was out in 1980 when the film was released. But there are other tunes out there. Of theirs, as you said, you got to get via bootlegs and stuff. And that footage of them at Winterland, which is their last concert. Again, I was watching an interview with Steve Jones. He goes, he was just counting down the songs. He goes, just fucking get me through these songs. I can't stand it. I need to get out of here.
So do you know why John Lydon quit the band? Was it he couldn't stand the other people in the group, or was it?
From what I saw on an interview with Lydon, he said that he got sick of the Pistols because he hates McLaren with a vengeance. I mean, McLaren's no longer with us. Be hailing with a vengeance. He goes, the whole thing dissolved. He goes, even the audience, they went from being individuals with their own. Everybody was an individual. It didn't matter. They weren't trying to dress like a particular way. They were just, that Sue Catwoman who was there, and you had, that midget who's in the film Helen of Troy. Mm-hmm. She was a frequent member of the Pistols gig and a one-time girlfriend of McLaren's as well. He goes, then he started seeing all the crowds coming in were just in leather jackets or in, all looking the same. He goes, they've been individuality just disappearing as I had enough. He left and formed Public Image Limited, who honestly I think are a far superior band musically.
100%. And that I think shows that he's the guy in that group who had all the talent and charisma, just you watch that footage, that old footage of him in this movie. There's all this archival footage of him performing with them, and I'm just going, oh my gosh, that guy is a real punk rock star, I'm always I find his energy when he performs so infectious, and I still love how even today he pisses people off.
He's the only real punk rocker left.
Yeah.
The rest of them are all conformist idiots.
This
has been, the last couple of years has been the year that punk revealed most of these guys were phonies.
Oh yeah,
he's
all
one of the only real ones. I'm sure if Johnny Ramone were alive today, he'd probably be one of the real ones.
Yeah, I agree.
But it's just they're all regime bootlickers, Lydon's always, I've always thought that he was one of the only real individuals, like, thinking outside the box, actually kind of contrarian, but in a, he's kind of like Dr. House or something.
He's also one of the few who's from the working class, like legit, because like all the members of the Clash, like their fathers worked for, the government, State Department.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Man. Yeah.
Yeah. The Clash were almost like a psyop, just the whole like, oh, we're pub rock, we're going punk. It's like,
And a lot of those guys were like going back to the 60s. Zappa's dad worked for the, I think, a defense man, arms manufacturer.
Yeah.
Something. And Jim Morrison's dad, I think, was a general. So it's like all these guys came from very suspicious backgrounds.
Terries, yeah.
David Lynch's dad was worked for the Pentagon or something.
That would not be surprised.
Although he's like, you know, I thought my dad was dumb when I was a kid. He'd walk to work in a cowboy hat. But now I think he was a real, he was his own man. But a lot of these punk bands, even today, you know, you kind of see a lot of, it's a lot of rich kid LARPing, you know, as gutter punks. You know, they're rich, but they go out and pretend, they go out and dress the part, and they go and drink beer at these halls and act stupid. They put the safety pins through their ears or whatever. But, you know, it's and I heard John Lydon say, he goes, the safety pins, he goes, that was poverty.
It was, yeah. You guys, they had nothing to hold their clothes together with, so it was safety pins. So, and that's the whole thing, I think, that Lydon was getting to with the lack of individuality amongst the audience that were coming through towards the end. They're all dressing a way instead of just being themselves. He probably would have probably enjoyed some more just coming in a fucking t-shirt and a pair of jeans, just look doing their own thing instead of dressing up with the fucking safety pins and the star and just looking cookie cutter.
Yeah.
Remember back in the 90s where you'd have the grunge, it was all the flannel shirts, it was all the canvas shoes, and just
that got old quick. Boy, everybody's looking like lumberjacks.
Yeah, like you
long-haired lumberjacks playing Black Sabbath riffs. Whoa, there's grunge.
It's just like they got $4 to their name, and they, in all honesty, they probably got a small fortune squirreled away.
Well, and just, so, and speaking of that, okay, it's kind of weird because, you know, punk has this street working class origin that quickly gets seized upon by, you know, rich kids, corporate, the oligarchs, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, the Sex Pistols, like this movie, you know, Malcolm McLaren is the guy who put this band together. Okay. This movie makes him seem like he's the guy. Like he's
like some sort of Svengali,
like he's Jim Steinman and their Meatloaf or something, you know, like, you know, and it really oversells his role. But I've always found it fascinating that the Sex Pistols were a manufactured band that were legitimately street punks. They're not the Backstreet Boys where it's like, let's get some singers and put them together and get them some songs. And
well, I think their origin's disputed because I believe Jones and Cook were like
friends.
Yeah, they were like school buddies, and apparently they were already forming the band, and McLaren approached them about managing. And I think that's when they got Johnny Rotten, because I believe he auditioned at McLaren's store or something.
He sang I'm 18 by Alice Cooper.
Yeah, that's the famous story, because he was a big Alice Cooper admirer.
Yeah, Alice Cooper is kind of the unspoken father of punk rock, because, you know, those early Alice Cooper records, well, not the Frank Zappa ones, but like, like Killers, you know.
Yeah, when they signed to Warner Brothers.
They've got this edge to them. Like Alice, the way Alice Cooper sang, I think, with, you know, that has been so influential in heavy metal and punk, you know, that.
Ian Dollar Babies, for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The sneering that he does when he's singing. And also, if you listen to those radio ads from the Sex Pistols US tour, immediately they're compared to Alice Cooper. It's like it's even darker than Alice Cooper or more shocking than Alice Cooper. Like you'll hear it on those ads if you look them up on YouTube.
And in this film, Malcolm keeps talking about, well, this band couldn't play. No, Sid couldn't play.
Right.
Everybody else was perfectly capable.
They were competent. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I remember, I loved it in Filth and the Fury when the first bass player, what's his name? Glenn Matlock was like, I left the band, but Sid couldn't play. He's like, I was disappointed because Sid couldn't play a note. He's just like, you know, I couldn't play at all. I mean, you know, you're not going to show me, you know, John Lydon up there doing his Richard III act and like these other guys playing and tell me that this is a band that was zero talent. And so McLaren sets up this narrative that the Sex Pistols were just an idea in the press. They didn't really play. They were just something shocking that we built up. And then it fell apart because people saw them in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And then the word was out, they couldn't play. And I'm like, but I'm seeing footage and I've heard albums where they're actually playing, you know,
like, yeah. Look at McLaren's career afterwards. Like his only big discovery, I think, was Bow Wow Wow.
Didn't he have a hip hop phase where he got into rap?
Yeah. Breakdance. Yeah. With Pasta Dutchie. He did that song. I think it was.
Yeah. He collaborated with Africa Bambaataa, I think, on a, or am I thinking of John Lydon? I think he did Self-Destruction with him, but I know that McLaren thought rap was going to be the next big thing or hip hop culture. And so he put out some cash in stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, this documentary kind of serves to squeeze a few more bucks out of the Pistols as they're imploding for McLaren, but also to set himself up as, you know, he's Oz. He's the man behind the curtain.
Yeah.
And this whole thing, this whole Sex Pistols thing, it was really me. You know, it's sort of him trying to reposition himself as the guy who gets all the credit. But
hence why we got Filth and the Fury without his involvement to rebut the whole damn thing.
Yes. And I love that whenever they use Malcolm quotes, they use the GIMP mask footage from
in the rubber
movie.
Suit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they never mentioned that McLaren destroyed the New York Dolls. He took over their management and put them in commie leather outfits and stuff.
Right. He was had them in red leather outfits. Yeah. Remember that? Yeah. Yeah. Remember seeing photos of that? Might have even been the time around Blackie Lawless being in the Dolls.
Yeah. I think Lawless was in the group at that time.
Yeah.
Of which I don't think any footage survives or recordings or whatever.
No, I don't think so. But I mean, I was thinking about, never mind the bollocks. As good as an album as it is, if you look at the debut albums of Sex Pistols, Clash, Damned, the big three of the British punk, you got Never Mind the Bollocks, The Clash, and you got their self-titled one, and you got the Damned. I found one that's actually better than all three of them. Came out the year after in 78. Buzzcocks' first album, I think, is much better than all of them.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. I even think the Jam's first album is far superior to any of them.
I haven't heard of the Jam's one, but man, that Buzzcocks' first album is fucking great.
Yeah.
I don't think the Damned really got good until Captain Sensible took over on guitar.
Well, the Damned, their recorded material is kind of, it's not that great. Live, they're terrific.
Yeah, their live albums are what I go for.
They are a live band. Yeah, they are a band that you appreciate live. I never liked them that much until I saw them live opening for the Misfits in one of their mutated forms.
Yeah,
I think when Dave Inyan's wife, Patricia, was actually on guitar or bass guitar. I can't remember which. And but they were really good. They were better than the whatever form of the Misfits I saw that night.
And Captain Sensible's constantly bantering.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they'll play like a song about Michael Jackson. They're like, what do you think he got up to with Bubbles?
I met Captain Sensible back in, I think, 2001. He was at an in-store. He was gone. He was absolutely trashed off his face. I mean, he's likable, but he was wasted. He was high on speed or something.
And, what's his name? Dave Vanian's always, he's always kept to himself, you know, always been very mysterious.
I know a girl I used to work with when I worked back in the shop that McLaren used to work in, that field of, which I won't say what it was, work it out for yourself. And she was a companion of Dave Vanian, she told me, when she was living in England. Companion. And she said when they would come together, he was more in love with himself than he was with her. He was very fond of himself and his good looks.
Well, there you go. I mean, you have to pick up on that when he was doing stuff like Eloise, and he's got the big flowing.
Oh boy, the flowing mane with a white stripe down the side.
Oh, yeah. It's just terrible. You know,
it is awful.
And
they're a good band, the Damned, but you always had to keep up with them because they were always changing.
Yeah.
You know, you go from those first two, even the third one, which I think is their best, Machine
yeah.
Gun Etiquette.
That, yeah, that's best. When Captain Sensible moved to guitar, and I think that's yep. when it clicks.
And then you got that, then they moved to the Black Album, and you think, oh, this is different.
Yeah, it's goth. Different. They turned into goth a goth album. Band. Yeah.
And they still have a very loyal goth following.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I know. Goth scene. My friends who like The Damned also like the first two Cult albums and, you know, like Killing Joke and yeah. Sisters of Mercy and stuff right. like that.
Yeah. But, and then they go from the Black Album to Strawberries, which is different again. And they go to, Phantasmagoria, which is even different. So it always, they might have been ahead of themselves a bit too much, The Damned, but people were going, what the hell are you going to get this time? You don't know, so they lose their core fan base of punk days, trying to get in the goth crowd, and they try and get in the sort of pop crowd. So that's where their failings may have come along the way, but yeah, don't know if it's still going, but I did see an interview with Rat Scabies, and oh man, he's going to the same dentist. He's got the same dentist as Shane McGowan of the Pogues.
No, the Damned like, are still one, two, going. Three, one there. The Damned are still going. They put out an album in 2018.
Evil Spirit? Is it the one? Spirit or something?
Yeah, and they put out a live album not too long ago, I think. But it says they're still active on here. Where right. I'm looking.
Yeah, they played here like 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
But there was they had a competing version for a little bit with Rat Scabies and who was their original guitar player?
Brian James,
yeah. I think they had a competing Damned.
So it was like Hawkwind, how there's like the rival from the old guys in the band. Right.
I cannot stand those rival bands. Rat were the first one I can remember who did that. It's like okay, you only see we got Rat on the poster. You're going to see Stephen Pearcy's Rat. You're going to see Bobby Blotz's Rat. You're going to see Warren DeMartini's Rat. Who are you going to see? You don't know.
Well, that happened with Great White. One of the competing Great Whites is the one that burned down that club. Because members of Great White will constantly correct people in interviews. So they'll go, oh, the club. They're like, this version of the band had nothing to do with that. You know,
you'll get out of here alive. Don't worry.
Yeah. And what was it? There was like a management group that was going to former members of bands and getting them to start competing versions of bands.
Ugh.
Like this group did it to Steppenwolf, former members of Steppenwolf.
Ugh.
And they did it to the first singer of Deep Purple. And they would trick them into signing a contract where they were legally liable for stuff. And in both cases, what was it? John Kay sued those people into oblivion, and the band had to take the fall for it. Management group walked off with the money, and the singer of Deep Purple, the first guy before Ian Gillan,
Rod Evans.
Yeah, Rod Evans. He started one, and he got sued, and like nobody's heard from him since.
Well, that used to be a scam they ran in the '60s, where they'd have a fake Yardbirds, a fake Fleetwood Mac when they were blues rock band. Because you didn't have a lot of TV exposure for these bands, so nobody knew what they looked like.
Yeah.
And very frequently, they were not photographed on their albums. And you could get away with that scam. And that might be one reason they got big on selling, you know, photos of the band and the image and everything, is to prevent that sort of scam job from going on.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Reminds me of that story that Dr. Heathen Scum said that the mentors couldn't get any gigs, so they sent a tape off to some place. To see if they can get a gig, and they sent them Deep Purple's Live in Japan and got the gig.
That's funny. So what were you going to ask me, Stu?
I was going to say, should I have forewarned you about watching this before you watch this? Because I forgot about all the nudity,
I figured it's a Sex Pistols thing, so I made sure I was, you know, not going to be compromised when I watched it. I did not expect to see Malcolm McLaren's penis or so much of it in this film.
Or Steve Jones. Or yeah. Ronnie Big. Or Paul Cook.
I figured there was going to be some degeneracy in it. I did not expect as much as there was, but this is not a movie where I would go like, hey, let's put it on, you know, like the background.
Oh, I can actually very easily. Yeah.
No, I figured there would be some stuff in there, but I did not expect to see, you know, as much as there was.
It's kind of got an ill-fated cast as well, because it's got Vicious, who died young.
Yeah, did he die before the movie came out? Because there's a lot of, at the very end, there's all the headlines.
Yeah, he was dead before it came
out. This was filmed in 78, released in 80, so it was a two-year gap between filming and release. Hence why I was going to say, over the end titles of Friggin' and Riggin', which I thought you would have picked up on, Hunter, having heard that before by Anthrax, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Song? On the B-side of one of their Among the Living songs, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which, by the way, that Anthrax version is crap.
Yeah.
Musically, it's okay, but they rewrote all the words from Friggin' and Riggin'. I thought, all right, if you're going to do that, make it your own. But it's not funny. And the worst part is, not only is it not funny, they reference and name drop Eddie Trunk in the song. So that's it. Lights out.
Do you know the other band that name dropped Eddie Trunk in a song?
No.
Freely's Comet.
No. I think Ace knows better than to do that. I think Ace knows better than.
He's
I think
his best friend.
I think Ace already knows that Eddie is borderline stalker at this point.
We signed them to Megaforce.
No, there's a band, you know, the band Overkill referenced Eddie.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. They have a line in the song, I think it's Old School, where they go, "Can you believe they played us on Eddie Trunk?"
Oh no. That's off that Wings of War album. That's a damn good album. But
Overkill is an awesome band. I like Overkill.
Seen them live. They're fucking ripped live.
Yeah,
so good.
Yeah, they're one of those bands that is, they're like Motorhead, where every album
chug along.
They know how, they know the formula. They're you're gonna get a ripping metal record no matter what, you know.
And Bobby Blitz, very what do you call it, free market advocate he is.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm sure Eddie is as well, you know. I mean, all that kind of crew he has, they just kind of, I don't know, some of them are more quiet.
There's a drummer, the drummer in that band that used to be the drummer from the first two albums, Ratskates, his name was, back then, did a documentary, it's on Amazon Prime here, maybe over there.
Use my VPN if it's not.
Yeah, I think it's called Hello from the Basement or something. And it's about the very, very early years of Overkill, from when he started it along with right to it, including, I think, release of the first album and his departure from after the second one. But it's a good good documentary.
I'll check that
out.
About
an hour or so. It's very short. It's a good watch. But we're getting way off track of the Sex Pistols.
Yeah, now we're talking about heavy metal. This is,
which is
heresy.
Yeah, really, it is. But John, what were your thoughts?
Well, I first saw this, I think, when it was released on VHS in America, I believe back in 1992. And that's when I saw it for the first time. And it's funny because back then, pretty much all I was watching was probably every edgy movie, you could think of back then that I could rent at a video store, because video stores were filled with the latest Paul Schraders and Abel Ferreira and anything degenerate. So nothing shocked me at all. I was like, maybe the flashes of male nudity were a little surprising, because you didn't see that in movies.
No.
Not that I wanted to. But no. I thought it was interesting back then, but I didn't know a whole lot about them. I'd read the one book, England's Dreaming, that had all the details, but it's a pretty tedious read. But that had a lot of info about it, but I didn't remember the info when I watched it. So I kind of just accepted Malcolm McLaren's story as, okay, this is what happened. Then years later, more reading about it, more Johnny Rotten interviews where he shoots from the hip as always. And the Julian Temple Filth and Fury documentary seemed to correct the record. It was a complete overcorrection. And I thought, okay, well, now watching this, 30 something years later, almost 30 years later, I'm like, God, this whole thing is just propaganda.
It is
bullshit, pretty much. It's baloney.
apart from the fact that he had a hand in creating the Sex Pistols, only had a hand in, didn't do it solely on his own. Right. The rest is all, it's all bullshit.
It's like having the Ramones accountant, like on a documentary saying created the Ramones. But and also, if you look at it, he blew it. I mean, they should have been the punk rock Beatles, and they weren't. And it's like, cause he blew it. He put them in redneck bars through the South and stuff, like the worst possible markets for them.
You ever feel like you've been cheated?
Yeah. It's like, yeah, he was, because he, Malcolm McLaren screwed them over. They didn't make any money. And he put them in there, these stupid gigs as like a, it was like an art stunt or something, like some Warholian thing.
Well, that's what he tries to make it seem like in this film is, haha, look at what a brilliant artist and scam artist I am.
Yeah.
But it's like, you were playing the short game, you idiot. This is a long game.
It should have been the long run. The Sex Pistols should have been together for like 10 years, putting out these into New Wave, and then broken up maybe when New Wave took over.
Yeah.
And then John Lydon would have, you know.
The death of Sid wouldn't have helped, obviously. You would have lost him. But
But, you know, the death probably came about because of the breakup in some ways. You know, he's in New York not doing anything and just getting further into heroin.
And he was murdered. Nancy was murdered by Rocket's Red Glare.
I honestly think
the guy in all the Jim Jarmusch movies with the terrible teeth, the guy who shot Eric Bogosian at the end of Talk Radio.
Yeah,
that guy. He killed Nancy.
He reckons he did it.
An interesting bit of trivia that I remember reading in zines around that time, and I see nothing about it on the IMDb listing, is some of the Brazilian footage is believed to have actually been directed by Russ Meyer and scripted by Roger Ebert. Yeah, because they started filming the movie with a Roger Ebert script, and Russ Meyer was directing it, and that didn't work out. Like, they did like 2 weeks of footage and decided, okay, this isn't going to work out.
So Roger Ebert did not like. So all the Holocaust jokes were written by Roger Ebert.
Possibly. but I
like that. Co-write on Belson was a guess.
Yeah. That Martin Borman actor, that's an American actor from LA. So he was probably brought down there by Russ Meyer, the guy playing the old Nazi.
So do you think when this movie came out, Russ, what's his name, Roger Ebert turned red and went, huh?
I don't know. I know that there was some Johnny Rotten special on VH1 where he's at the Cannes Film Festival and Roger Ebert's trying to get his attention, and Johnny Rotten's pretending he can't hear him. And he can't deny that Roger Ebert's there. He goes, "Oh, Roger, how are you?" And then Roger Ebert's like, "Oh, remember when I wrote the movie and we were filming and all that stuff?" Yeah. And John Lydon did not. He didn't like Russ Meyer when they were filming that stuff, and he did not like
John Lydon.
I didn't like Roger Ebert.
Was he still in the band?
Lydon, he was still in the band when they were filming that stuff, but it wasn't coming together. But for whatever reason, they didn't use any footage of Johnny Rotten in the Great Rock and Roll Swindle that they filmed for it.
Might
have been a clearance issue or whatever. Yeah. They could only use his performance stuff and use his likeness in a cartoon, and that was it.
Wow.
A guy I knew in Memphis, he's recently passed, but he told me when he lived in Chicago, he was at a bar and he was sitting at the bar, and a hammered Roger Ebert came up to him and was like, "You're in my chair, buddy. I'm gonna fight you." And like Roger Ebert was like, "Get out of my chair. This was back when he was drinking, you know." And he goes, and he was like, "Yeah, Roger Ebert was really pissed that I was in his chair." And he goes, "Yeah, he's an alcoholic, you know, he can't, you know."
Did it knock his jaw right off?
Yeah, I was going to say.
But yeah, he said Roger Ebert was like ready to kill him over this chair. You know?
That's hysterical. It makes sense. He was a degenerate. You
know? Yes, Low Res's memes are amazing.
Yeah, those are the best.
Just, one of my favorites is, so for those of you at home, Low Res does these memes where it'll have Roger Ebert, that picture of him smiling, and it'll have some piece of crap movie and then quotes from his review praising it. And then he'll have some movie everyone likes. It's like a classic. And it'll have Roger Ebert, like, with his face is red. And then all the stuff he hates about it. And he's like he had Batman and Robin, and he's like, the Batmobile looks cool. And he's smiling, and he's like, oh, such a fun movie. And then he's looking at the original Batman, Tim Burton one, and his face is red. He's like, huh? Should anybody even watch this?
Characters are repulsive. Yes.
Yeah. Like... My favorite is, huh? Writing "huh" in a review—that
is—that is Larez's best running gag, like ever. Like he's just
so funny.
He's got the perfect formula.
That meme and the ones where he was making fun of South Park, like have some guy smoking weed at Jerry's. Like, hold on, it's Cartman just cursed. Turn that up. Like he hates South Park.
But, yeah.
Oh man, just good original content, you know.
Let's just go off on a quick tangent now, stray away from the great rock and roll swindle for a second, and talk about a little known film called The Farmer getting released on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, we got to talk about that.
Yeah.
And
so I just found out via either someone posted in the group, or I think I saw it on Blu-ray.com. I think, honey, you posted in the group.
I did.
About it being released. I'm like, okay, so what? I really haven't been on social media a great deal the last 5-6 weeks, barely. So what's happened? What's now all of a sudden gotten this film out? It can't be the podcast we did, surely. Because it's too coincidental.
That had something to do with it.
You think so?
If you go to our YouTube upload,
right,
on the comments, a certain Bill Olson, who runs Code Red and has supposedly bought the rights to this film 15, 16 years ago, is disputing things Chris Boggiali, our guest, says on the show. And Chris hits back and corrects him. He says, as I said on the show, and clarifies things. So they were, Bill was listening. And within about a week, and he's always claimed he couldn't release it for legal reasons or, you know, rights disputes or something. I forget what it is. Suddenly, those all cleared up a week later, and they announced a release on Dark Force Entertainment, which is really just a sock puppet company for Code Red. So it's coming out. Wow. It's up for pre-order at Diabolic. Now, I'm probably going to buy it. Buy it. Why not? I'd like to see a good copy of it. But coincidentally, over the weekend, our associate, Eric Zaldiver, sometimes third micer, interviewed Gary Conway and has also interviewed another actor in the film and is talking to the original scriptwriter, who was a woman who wrote this thing originally.
John, how did Eric come around to speaking to Gary Conway?
I think Chris hooked him up with the contact info and he pitched doing an interview with him. And he had a pretty good detailed interview with Gary Conway. About his whole career.
And if you're friends with Eric on Facebook, he posted video of Gary watching The Farmer.
Yeah.
Oh, gee. Okay.
Reacting to it. You know, going, this is so 70s. They would never tolerate this now. You know,
good
little stuff like that.
So now is Eric's stuff gonna be on the Blu-ray release?
No, it won't. It's too late to be on the Blu-ray, but Eric's gonna figure out something to do with it. He's gonna work out on something.
They can't put a second disc as a bonus features disc of interviews. Obviously, if you can't put it on the original one now because they're all pressed, I understand.
Right. That's the reason for now. It's possibly you're going to see, they're going to figure out something. Eric wouldn't do it for nothing. So he's going to come up with something, I think. Some way that people will be able to see it. Even if he just puts it on YouTube or whatever, as on his channel, which is worth subscribing to. Who knows? But it's unknown right now what exactly is going to be done.
Yeah, be a shame. I mean, I wasn't much of a fan of the film, but then again, the quality was atrocious. That was really hard to follow.
Pretty awful public domain copy, but that did get the ball rolling to get this thing out.
You know, I didn't love it, but I'm very much looking forward to seeing it.
I expect they whip out your junk in about a month or so of time with YouTube.
Copies, The Farmer.
We'll all be doing the like soy face, like.
I can't afford to import it from the US. It'll cost me an arm and a leg.
Just have Nez send it to you.
Yeah, Nez will send it.
Yeah. He just sends me good shit like Kill Street Blues.
Yeah, that's right.
Man, but
who's this company? The Diabolic? Is that what they call?
Diabolic.
They're selling it.
Send me one. I'll give my address. Hit me up and I'll give my address. I think I said to them, you guys will never release it, so why bother? Just bootleg it. So I think so.
Well, they're taking pre-orders now. I don't know if anybody's actually gotten a copy yet.
No, it hasn't come out yet.
So I wouldn't jump the gun too soon. It could be stopped at the last minute.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, when it's literally on shelves, you know, in your house, you know, having sent out in the mail, whatever, is when it's out. Yeah, because this thing could be pulled at the last minute.
But my understanding is the pre-sales have been incredible. Like the pre-orders, in the thousands.
It's actually you can't pre-order it on Diabolic anymore. It's out of stock.
Oh wow!
Because they pre-sold every advance, every order. Because I think you were printing up 2,500 or something like that, or 1,000. And the Olsons were going around saying only 30 people would buy this movie. Obviously, not true.
So they'd be fools to just make those 2,500 available and that's it. I mean.
Yeah, they're going to keep going. Well, they did the limited edition, slipcase.
That's what this is.
Slipcase, is it?
It's a slipcover copy,
Yeah, something nobody, I don't personally care about, so.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't sit there. I mean, it's like the people on Blu-ray.com on the forum go, oh, why couldn't they just do it with a steelbook? I mean, screw your steelbooks. Who cares? What are you going to do with them?
Steelbooks?
Yeah, remember when Anchor Bay would put them out in, cookie tins? They had the Beyond and those cookies.
Oh, I've got my King Kong ones like that. Yeah.
I miss the cookie tins. Eat up so much space.
The thing I don't like about steelbooks is if you have a couple of them together, they go whoosh, everywhere.
Yeah.
The way they rub up against each other, they fly apart. It's just there's nothing, there's no what's the word? There's no grip, But anyway, the farmer.
Buy yourself these, people. Holy shit, they cost nothing. These protectors.
Yes.
I should get those for my few cardboard snap cases, like the early Warner Brothers releases.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My Filth
every Blu-ray, every DVD, every CD I've got has got them on there.
My Filth and the Fury DVD is a Warner Brothers snap case.
Oh, is that the one that's called Pissed? It's got on the front, P-I-S-T.
Oh, yes, that's it.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's the American one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Surprisingly as well, that this is put out by Shout Factory.
That seems like something they'd put out.
They're real big on clearing, on music clearances. They're real good at that.
Mm-hmm.
That's why.
That's my next question. This is now a 2003 or 4 release, so we're looking at nearly 20 years since this has been its last home video release. I'm starting to wonder, is there now music clearances or rights clearances for this not being re-released in the high def format? Or as Julian Temple just said, which I can't believe he would be saying this, can't be bothered, not interested in revisiting it, which I don't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
Could be lack of consumer interest.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably just,
The farmer?
Yeah. Only 30 people would buy it.
Well, the thing with the farmer is it was never released on home video, ever. But there are certain things that were big in the 70s or 80s, 90s. They don't sell on DVD. Perfect example, Mary Tyler Moore Show. That's a well-loved American TV show. Was big in syndication in the 80s and 90s. And they put out the DVD sets in the 00s, and they didn't sell. So they never finished the releasing them or anything. And there's several shows that they were surprised at the lack of sales. Sometimes it's just consumer interest just falters on stuff that's 30, 40 years old. Yeah, and the Sex Pistols, there's not much of a career or discography that you can really exploit, sell to kids and young people. Like they're not seeing this band that continue. They're seeing a band that burn out.
I was in the car with my 15-year-old before just picking something up, and we were actually talking about it. He goes, Dad, if they put this out on Blu-ray or 4K, he goes, first day I'm buying it. I want it. So, I mean, it's a 15-year-old kid.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's not the only one around. There'll be, many other kids who are but getting into these punk bands, but then going back.
Yeah. Gone, no, right? I've noticed with teenagers, there's a renewed interest in punk. So we could see it in the future. I think that like millennials, I'm sorry.
It won't be the same.
No, but I think
it'll be like the Green Day punks back from the mid-90s, the fake power pop fast punk shit.
Right, but I've noticed a renewed interest in the old stuff. You know, like I've noticed that there's teenagers who are into Black Flag. They're into, you know, like the Ramones. You know, they're into like older stuff. Not the teenagers I've talked to who like punk rock, they hate the 90s stuff. They don't like the pop punk stuff.
I was surprised how young the kids were at the Circle Jerk show I went to like 10 years ago. It was like, I was like, they have young fans.
Yeah. They like them. They like, what was it? Minor Threat. Like, you know, they like the kind of that kind of hardcore stuff from that time, you know?
Yeah. Like young women at the Cramps. Like if I wanted to see good looking women back in my single days, I go to a Cramps concert.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh man, the best looking women were there.
Shit.
Because I think
that's surprising.
Yeah, it was, but you know, compared to like a Motorhead show where there's no women or a few that, you know, weigh about 300 pounds, but there's just very few women. But you go to a Cramps show, there were some good looking girls there, man. It was surprising. And young too. I was like, geez.
Yeah. Volbeat's got some competition.
Volbeat's the metal band that has all the pretty girls there.
Motley Crue of the modern day with the females.
No kidding.
A friend of mine went to Motley Crue in 1990 here for the Feel Good Tour, and he goes, it was just ridiculous. He goes, wall to wall women. Wall to wall. But the only other time I'd seen that of a concert I've been to of all people was Chris Isaak. That was fucking bullshit. That was just, I mean, it was good. It was like a 97% women, 3% men. It was nothing. There was hardly any guys there.
Well, the best looking crowd I saw was Australian bands. All these women were at I went to see Jet opening for the Vines. And
oh, hey, local boys.
It looked like a sorority party, the whole crowd. Good.
Oh wow.
They were there for Jet, and I guess they were there for the Vines as well. And the Vines were terrible, but Jet was a lot of fun. Yeah, they knew how to work a crowd.
Jet's a good
band. Yeah. Very popular. They're a band who imploded as well, but theirs was drug based.
That would make sense.
Had a very bad drug habit.
That was
they had a huge rise in America.
That was that minute in like 2003, 2004, where it was like, is rock back? Is it back?
Yeah.
The Darkness.
Because the White Stripes and Darkness.
The
White Stripes
and the Strokes. Yeah. And everybody was like, oh,
the Hives did a big tour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. That's the last phase of rock music in America that I enjoyed. I loved it.
It was like a minute where you had all this awesome rock and roll music, and then it just kind of went away, you know,
evaporated. Completely.
Just didn't.
I never really got into Turbo Negro much, though. I mean, they're okay, but they
put out a new album not too long ago.
Oh, did they?
Right.
Yeah.
Apocalypse Dudes is a great album, and the rest are just fun, but not as good as Apocalypse Dudes.
Okay.
That's the one I really liked. That it took a while, like maybe three listens, and then it just hooked me in. I was like, I started air drumming to it and all that stuff. So. But first listen, I thought it'd be heavier, and then maybe third listen, that's when you get into the air drumming and air guitaring and, you know, singing to the lyrics like Bam Margera.
Speaking of punk bands, I also rewatched, after I finished watching The Great Rock and Roll Swindle back in late December, I rewatched The Decline of Western Civilization 1. Mm-hmm. And notice just what an absolute knockoff of Sid Vicious' Derby Crash was.
Oh yeah.
Well, before his death, he went to England for like a month and hung out with Adam Ant, and he came back and he had the mohawk and he had the Indian dress and everything, just like Adam Ant. Like he was trying to bring that image to America, and the audience said whatever the mask or whatever, they didn't go for it. And they were mystified by him, and then he OD'd like I think the same day John Lennon was killed, so no one cared about Derby Crash. So
horrible band, the Germs.
The Germs are
they're dreadful.
Yeah, The only purpose, I think the only purpose, like that, I think Pat Smear is lucky he got that Foo Fighters gig.
Yeah. Yes, he is. He's very lucky.
The two things I took away from that, again, I think I mentioned it when we did that episode, was the Germs were awful, but Fear were awesome.
Fear are great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the goats.
Still touring. They were supposed to play here down the street from me, and I had to cancel because of all the COVID silliness. But yeah, they're still at it. Leaving follows me on Twitter.
Didn't give Leaving a chance to scream about how it's all bullshit. And
yeah, that's what I wanted. I went, Are you guys still scared of the flu? Huh? What are you, homosexual? What?
We're from New Jersey. We're from Fresno.
It's 2022. Can't you afford a fucking haircut? Jesus.
But I enjoyed that one. But getting back to this Great Rock and Roll Swindle, I mean, it's a patchwork job for sure.
Yeah.
You bounce around from, the footage from McLaren to songs and then cartoons and then.
And Steve Jones being like.
Jones looking for McLaren.
Acting like he's a PI,
It's the Game of Death of punk rock documentaries.
Oh, totally.
It's working around the lack of Johnny Rotten participation. So.
Yeah, honestly, it's just squeezing blood from that stone that is this band that's imploding in real time, and we got to get this movie out.
And I just had some weird visual as well. I had the woman with the ants crawling on her face.
Yeah, what's happening?
When she's berating Steve Jones, she's obviously not giving a shit what she's saying. She's got these ants crawling. I mean, it's surreal for sure in parts.
Yeah, that was like something from a Boonwell film or something,
That was part of the influence, probably.
Oh, yeah. So there's like ant stuff imagery in his movie.
Yeah, who's the female surrealistic director? Maya
Darren.
I think there's a lot of that. That inspired those guys back then.
Yeah, she was very influential on, avant-garde filmmaking, and that bleeds over to, that kind of artsy Warhol crowd, and that bleeds over to the punk rock crowd,
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a lot of art influence back then that you're not going to see in that scene anymore because music isn't like that, but that was probably the more interesting aspect of 70s punk, especially in England, was that kind of, that art influence.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Julian Temple is a very, very gifted visual artist as a filmmaker. He's so good. People just forget how good he is. There's also a 30-minute pilot episode he did around the same time. I think it was 1980. So this was, the film in 78, released in 80. This one was done in 1979 or 1980. And it's the 30-minute pilot to the comic strip Presents, The British Troop, which featured Adrian Emerson, Rick Mayall, Alexei Sale. Oh, was Alexei Sale in there? He may have been. Peter Richardson, Keith Allen. And when you watch that 30-minute pilot, it is so visually the same representative of the Great Rock and Roll Swindle. I thought, Jesus, looks familiar. Then I saw at the end, directed by Julian Temple. That's why. That's one to seek out. I mean, I got on a box set of the comic strip Presents, which is nearly all their films. I think Eat the Rich is not on there. And, so he's a really, really gifted visual filmmaker, but then he does stuff like Absolute Beginners. I think, really,
his sister was the chairman of the Communist Party in England.
No way.
At some point.
Yeah. That's like what was it? Going back to our non-friend Ron Jeremy, his sister was a political advisor.
Oh yeah, see, that these people are always connected to politics.
What's going on?
Very weird.
So they rebel in their own way, in their own field of doing some anti-politics, I guess.
Either that, or it's a psyop to make you more willing to accept that politics.
And I forgot that Julian's daughter is in Dark Knight Rises.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, she was in Atonement, and she was in that show Vinyl, and she's in Ted Lasso. Juno Temple.
Oh, that's his daughter. Oh, weird.
Yeah.
What's her name?
Juno Temple.
Yeah. Juno Temple. Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's been in a lot of movies because I remember seeing her in something and going, who is she? And I looked her up and I went, oh, dang, she's Julian Temple's daughter.
Oh, wow. There you go. But this film has actually got a woman called Mary Millington in it. Do you know her? You heard of her?
No.
British softcore actress.
That's her, yeah. She was the one in the film, Hannah, who played, she was in the theater with that guy watching the film. And the guy buggers off and she's playing around with Steve Jones.
Yeah.
And Nesbitt sent me a documentary about her called, can't remember. But it's a documentary about Mary Millington and quite sad as well because she was she wasn't very tall. She was only about 5 foot, or probably just under 5 foot, but a real, as you will, pocket rocket. Liked a lot of bedroom fun, if you will, to coin the phrase. But then killed herself at age 31 or 32. I think she died actually a year after this was made in 79 or 1980. So, and had a problem with pills or drugs or something like that, or alcohol. I think it might be alcohol, actually.
She was like the queen of the British softcore movies that they had a bit of a boom in the 70s with those. And like Koo Stark, who I think later dated one of the royals, was starred in a few of those. And yeah, there was like a big, they used to play on cable TV a lot in the 80s on American channels like Showtime and Cinemax.
Yeah.
Like Confessions of a Window Cleaner, that sort of stuff, you know.
So it says, it says here that she died by suicide at age 33 by an overdose of tricyclic antidepressant anafranil, paracetamol, and alcohol at her home at Walton on the Hill, Surrey. Her husband found her dead in her bed on 19th of August, 1979. She left four suicide notes, which were found near her body. In one of them, she had written, "The police have framed me yet again. They frighten me so much. I can't face the thought of prison. The Nazi tax man has finished me as well." In another note, her solicitor, Michael Kay, partly published in Private Magazine in number 59, Millington wrote, "The police have killed me with their threats. The police have made my life a misery with frame-ups. The tax man has hounded me so much, I will be made bankrupt. If he mustn't get anything of his 200,000 pound demands. He is a religious maniac." In another note to David Sullivan, she wrote, "Please print in your magazines how much I want porn to be legalized, but the police have beaten me."
Yeah, she did do hardcore stuff as well. More softcore, but some hardcore titles are out there. The documentary I'm thinking of is one called Respectable.
It's on Hulu in America.
Oh, yes. Really? Give it a watch. Yeah. I mean, keep your boy away from it because there are
definitely
couple of flashes of X-rated. But
yeah, I know what she's about because one of her softcore movies got a like a cheap DVD release of the early days of DVD from the UK. And a friend of mine who had he ordered a bunch of Region 2 stuff he couldn't play. I was one of the first people, I guess, in Boston to buy a Region 3 player. And he brought it over and I took a look at it. I was like, oh, okay. And that's how I learned about Mary Millington, this British sleaze movement of the 70s and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. But Nesbitt sent me that. And I'm like, yeah, as you heard of Mary Millington, I said, name rings a bell. I mean, obviously, I'd seen the name in this, but didn't really sort of register to it. And he goes, "Give it a watch." And I watched and I go, "Oh, really interesting. Sad tale of this woman. Really, really good looking woman as well." But
yeah.
This goes to show you got the looks and you know the fame and doesn't really mean much.
Nope.
No. She clearly had mental issues judging from the content of those suicide notes.
Well, and you know, only the most well adjusted people go into pornography.
Oh, of course. The very sensible people.
That is such an argument. It was such a discussion for another time.
Yeah.
Also, I've always wondered why primarily are the women the ones deleting themselves after they've done a career in it, but the men hardly ever.
I think it's because women, I think sex affects them more, you know, like
societal shame.
I think it's internal.
Internal. Okay.
Like I think there's something you know, when women are sexually chaotic, usually there's something from their past they're trying to gain control of, whether it's their father or they were raped or molested. A lot of times they're trying to gain control of it and they try to act out sexually to do that. And so those demons come out. Whereas I think with men, I think men can more emotionally distance themselves from sex in a way that women just can't. Usually when men are screwed up, it manifests in other, I don't know, usually they might be alcoholics or whatever, but you know,
but, or rapists like Ron Jeremy
you know, they become perverts. You know, I think that with women, there is, there's something with there that sex affects them in a way that maybe it doesn't with men.
Well, also the decision to go into pornography is seems like short-term thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
Like very low impulse decision making.
Yeah, it's very high time preference. You know,
it's signs of a lot of trouble there. You know.
Yeah, it's just there's usually something going on.
Yeah.
And and you know, I think that it, you know, it's a sign of sexual chaos is usually a sign of greater mental anguish, greater mental trouble, low impulse control, all that.
And with men like Harry Reams, they just become real estate agents.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, he's dead. He's dead now, but
yeah. He was like a real estate agent, I think, up in Colorado, up in the mountains, not far from.
Funny you bring up real estate agents, because that seems to be a profession that mostly when women get out of it, it's real estate. They just say, oh, register real estate agent.
It's perfect, because real estate is a tough game to get into if you're having to build your own brand. But if you're a celebrity, like you've been in the Alice Cooper band or something,
yeah,
you have instant name recognition. You can start that, you get that license, and boom, you've got a business. It's like a car dealership, you know?
Yeah.
You got that name recognition. Instantly people will go and buy stuff from you because they want to be close to you. Piece of the action.
You know, if I was to buy a secondhand car, who I'd want to buy it from?
Who's that?
Mike Rinder. He became a car salesman when he fled Scientology.
Oh, dang, you gotta get yourself a Mike Rinder automobile.
In Denver of all places, actually. So
oh funny.
John, go ahead.
Well, he's gone now. He's out of there now. He's back in Florida, but he was a used car salesman in Denver.
Well, do you guys want to rate the rock and roll swindle, the great rock and roll swindle?
Sure.
Should.
All right, Stu, you pick this. What do you rate it?
All right, well, I just want to say I think this film is surreal. It's unlike anything else. And honestly, I would say also watch this as a double feature with the Clash's film Rude Boy. Ironically, both films filmed in 78, but not released until 1980. Rude Boy, from memory, came out in March 80. Great Rock and Roll Swindle was May 1980. So really 2 months apart from each other. Do them as a double feature, and you'll get a snapshot of what Britain was like at the time. And all the upheavals going through politically and the garbage strike and everything else along with it. Also watch this as a double feature. Alternatively, watch this first, then watch The Filth and the Fury after it. It's another double feature you can do it as. It's unreal. Julian Temple is a genius, and I can't give enough in less than 10, honestly. I love it that much. I think it's unbelievable. As much as a patchwork job as it is, as disconnected as it is, you know, you've got Ronnie Biggs in it, a train robber who went from country, even lived here in Melbourne for a little while before he fled to Brazil. Yeah, the songs are great. The whole Black Arab scene is bizarre. And yeah, it's 10, man. It's got to be a 10.
John, what about you?
If The Filth and Fury had never been made, this would probably get like a 7 from me. But because it's kind of the record's been
corrected. Don't say it, John. Don't say it.
The record's been corrected. It doesn't hold up great, you know, watch it now, 30 years later. But I'm giving it like probably like a 5.5, because there's cool footage in it, but there's stuff in there that bores me, and Malcolm McLaren disgusts me. I mean, he really does.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. He's like the negative aspect of the Sex Pistols legacy. And seeing how John Lydon's come along and everything. I mean, saying he was fired from the band when he had clearly quit. I mean, that was like, well, no. But they actually say in the movie, oh, they fired Johnny. It's like, no. Like, even when I was younger, I was like, oh, that's nonsense. Mm-hmm. It's like, why are you going to fire the guy with the charisma?
The guy who is the band.
Yeah, yeah, it's just, it's propaganda. It's Malcolm McLaren propaganda. So I didn't view it that way in 92, but looking at it now, it's blatant. That's what it is. It just shows that, hey, you learn, you know, as more information.
You're looking at it from a documentary standpoint as opposed to a mockumentary.
Yeah, and I realize it's a mockumentary.
It's all bullshit. It's all lies. I mean, the whole thing, from start to finish, it's all lies. But,
he had a lot of people fooled. I'll put it that way. I've talked to the people in the business and everything who were completely fooled by that document, the mockumentary, you know, thinking, oh, Malcolm McLaren was a genius. It's like, really? Mm-hmm. And the numbers don't really add up for that, you know?
No. So for me, I'm more on the John end of things, but, you know, my thing with this film is it has stuff I love in it. Okay. Love the band doing a song with a train robber. That's cool. That's punk. You know,
Johnny Rotten didn't like that. It was a bloody thing. He stole working man's money.
Exactly. You know,
Johnny Rotten actually, sorry, honey, guys, for memory's sake, why the hell would I want to be involved in a film where they glorify a train robber who, don't forget, is also a murderer?
Of course.
Which is a good point.
Good point. No, I agree. But, you know, this is a band that's offensive, so it's offensive. So.
Yeah,
there we go. Number two. No, but I agree with Johnny, though. 100%.
Yeah, I do, too. Yeah.
But I love all the footage in there with Johnny. It's electric. He's incredible. I like the cartoon stuff. I like Sid doing My Way. All the stuff with Steve Jones and Malcolm McLaren is poison. Like, I can't. Yeah. I'm just like, during
that
all
mouse
that
game. The game of cat and mouse of Jones, Tracy, McLaren.
I didn't care.
That's all right. I get it. It's not, not everyone's going to get go, oh, well, this is cool.
So, like, you know, I'd give it a 5 out of 10. But the stuff like Sid doing My Way, that's culturally significant. You know, that's in Goodfellas. Oh, yeah. You know, they recreated it in Sid and Nancy. You know, that's a big number, and it's big for Sid Vicious, who has no talent.
Right. I think from memory, I read that My Way was actually quite a bit of a minor hit in 1980.
I believe it.
In Britain. Anyway, Nez would probably be able to clarify that a bit better when I speak to him next.
But, yeah, I actually preferred Sid's covering two Eddie Cochran songs.
Oh,
so come on, I think those are actually better, but
something else. Yeah, they are good. Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I would also say is that it's a movie to watch if you're a Sex Pistols fan, beyond just the songs. Like, if you're interested in the history of it, you know, this does give you a snapshot into a period of that last upheaval into that band. So it's essential viewing for Sex Pistols fans.
And it's also the fact that there's very rare or very few or limited footage, Sid Vicious available. He's dead, been dead for decades.
Yeah.
So there's not a great deal out there during the time of the Pistols real sort of up, you know, come up through the scene. This is with Glenn Matlock.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Everyone seemed to think that Sid Vicious is on the album.
He's not.
He's not. It's not. The actual bass in that album is played by Steve Jones. Mm-hmm. It's not Matlock and it's not Vicious.
He couldn't play. He's the only one who really couldn't play.
Yeah. He couldn't play.
He was unplugged, which shows.
Yeah. But I was getting at something anyway. But it's so limited amount of footage of Sid Vicious that this, I think, is important because we've got that.
Yeah.
And it's not to glorify Vicious, say, oh, it's just some sort of cultural icon. No.
Piece of history.
He's a piece of history, of course. You know, you still see people, you know, certain people running around with a Sid Vicious t-shirt. Granted, they're not 15-year-old kids, but they're not like the ones you see kids wearing the fucking Kurt Cobain t-shirt, I think.
People
you don't
like
know about Kurt Cobain.
People like Gavin McInnes.
Yeah. Sid was kind of like a Bruce Lee type thing. Died young, you know, had a certain charisma in the still photos. He looked like an icon.
And, yeah, and just like every dojo's got a picture of Bruce Lee, every punk band rehearsing at home has got a poster of Sid Vicious on the wall.
100%.
Yep.
Yeah.
Or a bumper sticker with Sid's face sneering or something. I've seen that a lot.
Sid made more money dead than alive.
Oh, yes. 100%.
Like Bruce Lee.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, it's funny to see the footage that we have got of Sid just strung out, but John Lydon swears up and down that he never used to be like that. He was actually a really funny guy, really straight. And once he hooked up with Nancy, that was it. That was the end of the stuff, John, the beginning of the end.
John Lydon has great affection for him, and he gets emotional in The Filth and the Fury when he talks about him.
Why did they film that in silhouette?
I don't know. I never worked out. I didn't really care much for that choice, but you can tell Lydon's very emotional when he talks about Sid's death and
all
that. Like, he gets very upset. You can tell.
He's done it a few times as well outside of that, where he's given interviews and, you know, he's had to stop himself short from getting worked up over Sid's death. So it's obviously affected him greatly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He just really wants to kill Rocket's Red Glare for doing that to him, Nancy. You know?
No, I'm sure he wanted to kill McLaren, but he never got his chance because McLaren is now gone.
Yeah. Well.
But I just think this is a great snapshot into time. That's not the whole reason why I'm giving it a 10. I do love the film, genuinely love the film.
Like all the surrealism and stuff.
The surrealism, the music, the time, much like Rude Boy as well.
Yeah. You
know, Rude Boy is what, 2 and a bit hours? And people are going to sit there and go, I'm bored. But I'm not.
No, I loved Rude Boy.
Rude Boy is a better movie.
Yeah.
Better time capsule of that era.
It's more cohesive as a story.
Right.
More coherent, too.
Coherent, yeah. It's the point. Yeah. What I was looking for, coherent. But, I love it. So anyway, we're gonna call it a day.
Yeah, well, first show of 2022 is in the can.
It is, and before we leave, we are not gonna forget Nez. We're gonna stick him at the end this week.
Okay.
Nez's piece. The one you're gonna hear, Anthony sent me just before Christmas, so it's a little bit outdated. His dislike for Boris Johnson's still as strong as ever in this one. It's a bit harsh.
One's going to be killer.
Yeah, I was going to say, just you wait.
I messaged Anthony Taylor, said, I'm going to use this one, the old one he gave me for this one, but go ahead for the next one, which I did. The conversations I've had with Anthony have been pretty red hot about Boris Johnson. Getting messages, he's gone, Stu, he's fucked, he can't survive this.
I expect nothing less.
out at work, I get a message from Anthony, Stu, he's gone, he's fucked, he can't survive this time. That was funny. But so yeah, the one you're going to hear from Nez for Rue Britannia at the end is done about the 20th of December. I got it the 21st of December last year, so it will be a bit old. As of next week's one, Nez will be back on with his more current ones. So there's that.
All right. Well, good with that, I'm going to go ahead and say adios.
I say peace out.
And now it's time for Rue Britannia with your foreign correspondent, the Nez.
This is your weekly briefing, and indeed at Christmas time you are most welcome to it. In a move that will surprise nobody other than fans of Spielberg's West Side Story, I'm joking, of course, the Christmas turkey died. The Tory government passed legislation through the Commons this week forcing mandatory vaccine passports upon all public companies and retail businesses. It must now demand all customers prove vaccination once and for all. 108 Conservative MPs defied a three-line whip in the Commons and voted against the government. Again. Essentially, although Shirley got his legislation through the Commons, it now means that he is now no longer in control of his parliamentary party. Most support now gone. They'll never follow him again. Kind of like the country. Wasn't all bad news though, the Tories celebrated their first and only Omicron fatality this week. Champagne was uncorked, crackers were pulled and cigars were smoked, as they effectively risked looking rather silly, hyping fatalities which stubbornly refused to occur. We just thank God we actually got our first fatality up on the board this week, Blue Government Minister Dominic Raab. We'd have looked like a right bunch of pilgers if nobody had actually died at Christmas, given the build-up and the hype, so give us some credit, people claimed. This just in time for the Staffordshire North by-election, where a Conservative seat of 200 years standing was won by the Lib Dems, in what was for them is a routine midterm by-election upset come shocker. We hear the message around Tory party chairman Oliver Dowden. It's not easy being a spice boy for the Prime Minister. So the voters, as you can tell, weren't asked by us to be more grateful for more authoritarian lockdown measures and more illegal immigrants. He railed. Labour, on the other hand, had a nightmare though that paled, with a blank slate and red carrying a very distant further 9% of the vote. For all the peace on earth and goodwill of the Christmas season, for all the lights and wreaths, for the company of family and friends, Shirley is still finished. If that's enough of a bad week for Field Marshal Blatter, his Brexit negotiator Lord Frost unexpectedly also resigned. His cabinet secretary also resigned from Shirley's internal inquiry into illegal Christmas parties last year. The Tory MP, charged with alleged rape, has had his trial date set. He's a Muslim. Doris. Nice guy. Kills people. Crime. And career arsonist Barbara Broccoli ramped up the creative stakes for the zombie squad at Letterboxd this week by touting the possibility of a non-binary bond. We think about nothing else at Eon these days, she boasted. Dad's dead, so me and Michael can take the train set in a multiverse of different directions. All work, of course. A disabled Bond in a wheelchair might be a way to go alongside the disabled Blofeld in a wheelchair. Or a female Jemima Bond taking on Spectre, you want to terrify the female Bond with boxes of mice. Or a black Bond to go with the black Moneypenny and the black Felix Leiter. The possibilities are endless, but just not in China, she gushed. Can imagine. The Bird with the Golden Gun, Skullfinger, it's Jemima Bond and beyond. Outer Space belongs to XYY, it's Jemima Bond's all-time high. Has Jemima Bond finally met her, his, its match? For your guys only, Octopussy, or perhaps Octococky. The world is not a muff, no time for pie. Thunder Slit, the ideas are positively endless. Anybody who wishes to complain should ring 1-800-007 and ask for Babs. And finally, Labour leader Keir Starmer was asked this week in an interview whether or not he was a socialist. What's a socialist? Asked the barrister. I'll give Keir a clue. Two words, four syllables. First word, two syllables. Sounds like Shirley. Who's a...
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.